Welcome to the Prancing Horse Podcast. Glad you can join us to learn about the history, news, and culture of the world-famous Ferrari. I'm your host, AJ, and I'm so excited to continue this podcast with our third history episode. My goal is to share the Prancing Horse legacy with not only current, but also future generations to come. This series is going to explain the history of the brand. Anyone can Google Ferrari, but I wanted to be able to provide you with an insider's perspective. I have been working in the service department of a Ferrari dealership for the last 10 years. I started my career with them as a car washer, then apprentice technician, technician, master technician, to shop foreman, and now I'm the service manager. I have done many training courses for the brand, everything from technical to managerial. I have also competed in multiple master technician competitions, and I did some challenge racing. I love Ferrari and what they create, so buckle up and let's talk history. After the Monaco Grand Prix that took the life of Bandini in our last episode, all of the tragedy brought some huge changes to the FIA and the safety of drivers. Following the race, straw bales were banned from the Grand Prix circuits. Also, the development of fire-retardant fuel systems and flame-proof clothing for drivers and marshals were prioritized, and camera crews could no longer fly a helicopter low over a burning car again. If nothing else, it was definitely a learning moment. This accident, as well as many others, ultimately made the sport safer for drivers, staff, and fans. Although Dino, Enzo's son, had been gone for some time at this point, we would see the first Dino road-going model in 1967, the 206 GT. Produced by Ferrari but sold under its own brand, the Dino Mark, with the body designed by Pininfarina and built by Scaglietti. The 206 GT used a transverse-mounted, all-aluminum 65-degree V6 with dual overhead cams and three Weber 40 DCN carburetors. The first car ever produced by Ferrari with an electronic ignition and a direct rack and pinion steering system, this was a technological leap forward for the brand. Using an all-aluminum body, fully independent suspension, and disc brakes on all four corners, this was a big deal. Up to this point, the cars had only been made with front engine designs, so this design did something completely new. Ferrari had never produced any such car for the road, an amazing wave towards his son who helped him design that very engine. A long production of the Dino was the 365 GT2+2, a truly luxurious car with lots of leather, power steering, and power brakes. Independent rear suspension and electric windows with the ability to add air conditioning quickly pushed this model to the top of the sales charts. 800 cars were produced in just 4 years. 1967 also saw the creation of the 275 NART Spider. Commissioned by the North American Racing Team, or NART, this was a special car built on the 275 GTB4 cam, but in a Spider version. Only 10 were ever built. Luigi Chinetti had intended to run 25, but due to low sales, this would not happen. With a yellow NART badge on the back and a canvas drop top above you, this was one of the most interesting and special cars to ever roll out of the arches of the Maranello factory. In 1968, Ferrari would develop the 212E, a car that had no successor or predecessor for a racing series they never formally competed in before, the European Hill Climb Championship. This was a one-off car starting life as a Dino 206S chassis that used a unique 2-liter flat 12 and a unique body. The car would go on to win 100% of every race it competed in 1969. Out of the 7 races it competed in that year, it took 6 course records, with one of those records holding that place for 13 years. Most people have never heard of this, and me personally, I think it's a really cool concept and part of the Prancing Horse history. On the assembly line in Maranello, you would also see the 365 GTC and GTS, the replacement for the 330 GTC and GTS. Increasing the displacement from 4 to 4.4 liters, the styling remained almost unchanged with the exception of minor changes, like vents moving from the fender to the hood. Using a new gearbox brought the car to a perfect 50-50 weight distribution. 168 coupes and only 20 Spyders would be built. Ironically enough, the successor to the 275 GTB4 was also released the same year, and this car is known around the world as the Daytona, even though this name was never officially used by Ferrari. The 365 GTB4 Daytona. The car radically changed style from the previous 275. Using a 4.4-liter V12 found in other models with 6 Weber carburetors and 352 horsepower. This was an answer to the Miura. With a front mid-engine configuration instead of a rear mid-engine configuration, Enzo was quoted as saying, "A horse pulls the cart, it doesn't push it." Media at the time would agree. With a 2-mile-an-hour faster top speed and a quicker quarter-mile time, it was labeled as the anti-Miura production car. It was also labeled as the best sports car in the world. With its sleek, modern front nose, and some being fitted in a plexiglass configuration instead of pop-up headlights, it was called the Daytona as a homage to the 1-2-3 sweep at the 24 Hours of Daytona in 1967. Bringing in the 1968 F1 season, Ferrari's performance in Grand Prix racing was pretty lackluster. New driver Jackie Ickx won the 1968 French Grand Prix but had few other successes. Things became even harder with the introduction of aerodynamic devices such as those found on the Lotus 49B, with a front wing and smaller rear spoiler which had never been seen in F1 before. By the time the season was over, Scuderia Ferrari would find themselves in fourth place in the Constructors' Championship, without a manager, and the only winning driver for that season moving to Brabham. The team as a whole was in a rough place. Enzo Ferrari was looking to revive his former world championship winning team without enough funding, so subsequently he sold 50% of the road car business for a whopping $11 million, or $96,313,850 today. This gave them the capital to ramp up production and focus funds even more on racing. This deal would be finalized in the early months of 1969. Enzo would also retain 50% of the business. The 1969 season would be even worse than the year before. With not a single win, Scuderia Ferrari would take home a fifth place in the Constructors' Championship and not a single first-place finish in any race that season. This was clearly a rough time for the F1 team. With its current car, the 312 F1, only winning 3 races in 4 F1 seasons. In 1969, we also saw the Dino 246 GT released, again under the Dino mark, but with a bigger engine and more power. We would later see a GTS or a Spyder version released. Those destined for the American market were detuned with more emissions regulations and timing chains. Just another example of how the regulations in our country continue to kill the passion that us car guys have. Ferrari would again come back to endurance racing in 1969, introducing the 312P. They would sit the 1968 season out due to a new engine capacity regulation of 3 liters on Group 6 prototypes. This regulation was put in place due to the high speed seen in the 1967 season by the 4-liter 330P4 and the likes of the 7-liter Ford GT40. Despite having a suitable engine that would have been used by the likes of the F1 team, Ferrari would sit this season out. But in 1969, with the 312P, Ferrari would bring a 3-liter flat 12 engine that was essentially a 312 F1 car with a Barchetta body on it, and then later that year with a closed-top Berlinetta. With Ferrari short on money during development, only one car would be fielded for the 12 Hours of Sebring. With Mario Andretti and Chris Amon at the wheel, they would take second place at Sebring, bringing rising hopes that the team was back on the up-and-up. However, the rest of the season would only show that the Porsche 917 in Group 5 racing was very competitive, and this gave Enzo an idea. For the 1970 season, Enzo would use the same loophole that Porsche did. Using some of his newfound wealth after the Fiat sale, Enzo would build 25 examples of his new car, the Ferrari 512S, to compete in Group 5. This was a 5-liter flat 12 engine with 560 horsepower. Even though it was 100 kilos heavier than the Porsche, it was later shown that they were fairly evenly matched in performance, but not reliability. Ferrari would win the 12 Hours of Sebring that year, but the Porsche 917 would take the other 9 victories. Even with the addition during the season of the 512M, which was a closed-top modificata version, resembling much more of that of the 917. The 1970 F1 season would see the release of the 312B F1 car, using a new flat 12 engine, and with the unwinning Chris Amon gone, Jackie Ickx and Clay Regazzoni would bring the car to a second-place championship finish in the World Constructors' Championship. 1971 would be about the same. Using the same car as the year before for the first three races, the newly signed American driver Mario Andretti would take victory at the South African Grand Prix in the first race of the season. With the new 312B2 taking the track on the third race that season, however, due to a new rear suspension and the switch to Firestone tires, the car would have a severe, teeth-rattling vibration when pushed to the limit. Unsuspected vibrations in a race car are not confidence-inspiring to a driver, and in my opinion, create a brain-altering block unlike any noise or visual issue you can see. So it's not surprising the car would only see one win and a multitude of retirements that season, mainly at larger, faster tracks. Overall, Ferrari would take third in the World Constructors' Championship. In the road car sector, with Fiat now on board, we would see some really cool updates to the lineup. The first being the 365 GTC4. As the successor to the 365 GTC, this wouldn't be just a simple engine update as we had seen previously. Taking the new sleek, updated, modern styling cues from the 365 GTB4 Daytona, the car would integrate pop-up headlights, the same Daytona chassis and suspension, essentially making a luxurious four-seater Daytona. Power steering, electric windows, and air conditioning were all standard. Instead of the downdraft top-mounted Webers like the Daytona, the 365 GTC4 would use 6 side-draft or side-mounted Weber carbs. This would allow a lower hood and overall a more wedge-shaped design. During its short 2-year production, only 505 examples were ever built. 1971 also brought us the 365 GTB4 competition. Based on the road-going version, the competition was up to 400 pounds lighter with the use of aluminum and fiberglass. Also, plexiglass windows and plexiglass front light covers. A total of 15 cars were made in 3 separate batches for the likes of its clientele who wanted to go racing with GT cars, such as the American-based NART team. Taking an outright win at the Tour de France and a class win at Le Mans, this was a pretty cool concept. Although factory support was almost nothing, many privateer teams found great success at the support of other race shops such as Holman Moody and the likes of others. For the first time in Ferrari history, the brand would break through the 1,000-unit sales mark. During the 1971 season for sports car endurance racing, the Ferrari 312 PB, as it would later be known, to avoid confusion with the original 312P, would make its debut at the 1,000 kilometers of Buenos Aires. At the pedals were Ignacio Guentini and Arturo Merzario. This car would look even more like the 917, but with a 3-liter flat 12 engine out of the 312B F1 car. Although these engines were not perfectly identical and interchangeable, they are very close. During that 1971 race, we would see another Ferrari fatality. During the race, Ignacio Guentini would run into the back of the Matra Simca's MS660 of Jean-Pierre Beltoise. Jean-Pierre Beltoise was pushing his car down the track after it ran out of fuel. This was well televised and happened in front of hundreds of spectators, without a doubt leaving a mark on what was needed to continue the improvement of safety and driver awareness on track. Due to the impact and subsequent fire, Guentini would soon perish and Jean-Pierre Beltoise would have his racing license suspended for some time. This would leave a huge cloud over the 1971 season and the team would not win a single race for the rest of the season. Their luck would change, however, for the 1972 season. With a win in every single race it entered, the only race it would not enter would be the 24-hour of Le Mans, as the team knew the delicate F1-based engine would not last a full 24 hours there. 1972 would bring a revised Formula One car from the previous year. After all of the issues they had with the rear suspension, they would move back to a more traditional setup. But due to lack of overall innovation, they would find themselves moving farther back in the field. Finishing fourth in the Constructors' Championship for the season, they would take a win with Ix driving at the 1972 German Grand Prix at the Nürburgring. This year also brought us the replacement for the 365 GTC4, the 365 GT4 2+2. Using a completely different styling method and a more square look, the car was visually different, but under the skin would remain almost identical to the 365 GTC4. Moreover, because of the US smog laws at the time, this car would again never be officially brought to the US. For the 1973 season, we would see Fiat intervene with the F1 affairs really for the first time. They would appoint a new technical staff and transfer Mauro Ferrigheri to the new experimental department, with his role being filled by Sandro Colombo, another engineer who previously worked at the likes of a motorcycle company and an Italian company that produced scooters and automobiles. Colombo would be crucial in creating the 312B3 for the season. With the new monocoque chassis and the engine becoming a fully stressed member of the car was used starting after the first few races and was a complete disaster. With the team not even competing in some races due to how uncompetitive the car was. During the summer, Forghieri was brought back as the technical director, showing maybe Fiat could purchase Ferrari, maybe they could increase road car production, but they couldn't race in F1. During this time, a totally new road car design was coming out of Maranello, using a flat 12 like many of their race cars, and for the first time, with that engine in a rear mid-engine configuration with a Ferrari badge instead of a Dino badge. The 365 GT4 BB was born. This was a major step for Enzo as he felt this configuration would be too much for his customers to handle, and took many years of convincing by his engineers to get him to do it. With BB standing for Berlinetta Boxer, this car would lay the groundwork for many iconic cars to come. Using a 4.4-liter flat 12, many of the parts and tooling were reused from the Daytona due to the similar displacement size. Also, the first car to use a timing belt meant the car was supposed to be quieter, easier to manufacture, and easier to service, although I find my preference to be in timing chains instead of rubber belts that must be changed at frequent intervals and are subject to contamination by oil, but I guess back to the car. Due to original low demand because of the 1973 oil crisis, Ferrari thought only 25 would be built. However, demand increased and a total of 387 would be built. Although none of the BB cars that would be made would officially come to the US, the car was given huge praises by the media and outperformed its predecessor, the Daytona, even though nobody could get it to its Ferrari claimed top speed of 188 miles an hour. Styling of the car was done by Pininfarina, and it was backed up by a tubular steel design with aluminum bits. The central portion was a semi-monocoque, with the front body panels being unstressed members, but only being supported by light subframes. Aluminum and fiberglass were also used to finish its clamshell-style rear engine cover. Along with it, another first, the Dino 308 GT4. Although being sold again under the Dino mark, this would be the first V8 rear mid-engine car sold that was built by Ferrari. Being a four-seat rear-engine V8, this engine would also be transversely mounted, meaning it would run from side to side, and the first V8 road car. Although originally believed by the media to be a replacement for the Dino 206 and 246, that was not the case. With new modern styling cues and Bertone at the wheel of the design, this would make another first for the mark. Many mocked the styling until many F1 and former F1 drivers praised it for its quality driving style and even stating it only has 8 cylinders, but every other measure, it's a Ferrari. 1974 saw a heavily modified car hit the F1 grid with the 312 B3-74. That's a mouthful. Although the monocoque from the previous model was used, Forghieri changed pretty much everything else. The radiators were moved to the flanks, the wheelbase shortened, and a tall periscopal type intake was installed. This is also the first time many of you may recognize a very famous F1 driver in one of these cars, Niki Lauda. Niki was accompanied on the grid in the red machines by the one and only Clay Regazzoni. Regazzoni that year just missed out on the driver's title, but overall he and Lauda brought the second place trophy for the Constructors' Championship home to Enzo. It would take 10 pole positions and 3 wins, which was as many in the last 3 years combined. But this would only be a foreshadow of what was to come the next year. This was also the year that Ferrari would fail to appear in sports car racing, only to focus on F1. Looking at the results, it was overall a good move. Ferrari wouldn't have a factory-backed team in prototype racing for another 50 years after this. Imagine being 26 years old, sitting on the grid in an F1 race in Monaco. This is what Niki Lauda was doing at the 1975 Monaco Grand Prix, sitting in a brand new car with a brand new boss. The 312T was an all-new chassis, a clean and uncomplicated design. Using the newfound transverse engine design, the car wasn't as light as the Cosworth-designed DVF cars that had been dominating the recent years. However, the power made up for it. With a similar power-to-weight ratio as those cars, the race would start under wet conditions. In a bold championship run with James Hunt, Lauda would continue to push to the end, even with fading oil pressure. Lauda would take first in Monaco. For the first time, Ferrari would stand at the top podium in Monaco, a first for the last 20 years. Lauda would go on to win 5 of the races that season in his new Ferrari. He would take home the Drivers' Championship and the Constructors' Championship that year. 1975 was also the year that divorce became legal in Italy. Any of you Ferrari historians may have been yelling at me up to this point, screaming, "But what about Piero?" Well, don't worry, I didn't forget. Somewhere around 1975 or 1976, Enzo's wife Laura realized something. A young man by the name of Piero, who'd been around the factory for a while, was actually Enzo's son. That's right, Enzo had another son. We are going to go slightly off rhythm here and finish the story of Piero on this episode. It's something that cannot be shuffled between multiple episodes, and I think it's important to address now. We have to go back in time here a little bit to 1945. Enzo had a mistress. Her name was Lina Lardi. They had a son named Piero Lardi. This was a well-known secret only revealed to Enzo's closest confidants. His wife Laura would refer to Piero as a bastard anytime he was seen around the factory. It would not be until after Laura's death that Piero would be recognized as Enzo's son. In 1978, Enzo would adopt Piero, and he would change his name to Piero Lardi Ferrari, taking his rightful surname and continuing to work at Ferrari. As of this recording in January 2024, Piero still has a 10% stake in Ferrari that was given to him by his father, and he is the vice chairman of the board. Thank you so much for joining us. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. As always, please make sure that you follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss any of our new content. Also, make sure to follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and PrancingHorsePodcast.com. And as always, Forza Ferrari!